Hi, I'm Peter G. Pappas, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Medicine Division of Infectious Diseases at UAB, and also Chair of the Scientific Committee of the Mycosis Study Group Education and Research Consortium. Our program today is focusing on invasive candidiasis, and we have seen this as a need. Our target audience are going to be healthcare providers, primarily those that are hospital-based. And we have generated several points that we believe are going to be important for discussion. And I have with me today my colleague and good friend, Luis Ostrowski Zeichner, who will introduce himself.
Thank you, Pete. Hi, everybody. My name is Luis Ostrowski Zeichner, and I'm a professor of medicine and epidemiology at UT Health in Houston. I'm also the director of the Laboratory for Mycology Research, and I work at the Mycosis Study Group as well as president-elect. And today, as Pete was mentioning, we're going to be discussing invasive candidiasis in a new format. We thought that it would be useful to create some infographics to discuss key points about the epidemiology, pathogenesis, risk factors, and treatment of this invasive disease. And the format today is going to be us going over the infographics and discussing key points about them, sort of highlighting controversies and key information with the ultimate goal of making people more aware about this devastating disease. Pete, do you want to start with the first one?
Absolutely, Luis, thank you. So to get us started, let's come to terms with really the terminology. We're all familiar with the term candidemia, but the more inclusive term really is invasive candidiasis, because candidemia is only, in some respects, the tip of the iceberg of a larger entity reflecting deep-seated candidiasis oftentimes. And so candidemia may occur alone as an independent event, oftentimes line-related. But as often as not, it may be a reflection of more deep-seated disease, such as endocarditis, disease involving the GI tract, or any other localized infection. And so the term invasive candidiasis is important because it includes not just candidemia, but all the complications associated with candidemia or invasive candidiasis that is non-candidemic. The reason this is important is for a number of reasons, of course. First of all, overall, it appears that candidemia or bloodstream infections due to Candida in some surveys represent the second most common bloodstream isolate in the U.S. And this is obviously extraordinarily important and deserves our attention. You couple with that the fact that in virtually every study, mortality rate is significant. And it ranges on the low end to 15% to 40% or even higher in individuals who present with sepsis. And then there's, of course, a cost of this average about $40,000 of extra healthcare costs, hospitalization costs associated with each episode of invasive candidiasis. And then kind of to further complicate this, it's the fact that this is not one disease, but it's really at least five diseases. Each organism, there are a number of different Candida isolates or Candida species. There's the most common ones being, of course, Candida albicans, Candida glabrata, Candida tropicalis, Candida paracelosis, and Candida krusei. And each of those have somewhat unique characteristics, whether they be clinical or whether they be resistance to antifungals. And so they each present a really important challenge. And so, you know, when you take all this together, this is a complex condition that is really sort of a healthcare associated infection. This was not terribly common before all the interventions that we saw in the 1950s and 1960s. And Luis is going to get into risk factors a little bit. But these are serious and complex problems that really deserve our attention. And then finally, antifungal resistance. This is a huge threat. It's an emerging threat. It's something that the CDC has designated as very sort of must-watch situation. And it relates not only to resistance to fluconazole by many species, but also echinocandin resistance, which is demonstrated by some Candida glabrata isolates, some Candida paracillosis isolates, and then, of course, multi-drug resistant Candida auris. So when you take all this together, this is an extremely complex, very important condition, very common, all too common, and something that we simply must know about.
Pete, do you want to talk about the difference between attributable mortality and crude mortality for this disease?
Sure. So, you know, crude mortality is just, you know, what we measure typically at 30 days after the onset of a episode of candidemia. And it can be due to a crude mortality can be due to a number of things. It can be due to a heart attack. It can be due to a stroke. Candida may or may not have anything to do with it. Attributable mortality, on the other hand, is where we really try to place some attribution to the infection, in this case, candidemia or invasive candidiasis. It's a much harder thing to do. And it oftentimes involves timing. You know, like for instance, did the patient die within 72 hours or some time frame that's predetermined that, you know, is allows you to say, well, it was likely this person died as a consequence of candidemia. Maybe the candidemia, not directly, but it set into motion certain things. So attribution becomes very difficult. I think the only times we're ever absolutely sure of it is when an individual has positive blood cultures at the time of death. And even then there may be some doubt. So attributable mortality is a tough one, but it usually relates to the timing around that episode when the diagnosis is made. And we do our best to try and define it pretty clearly. I think the easier thing perhaps is the overall mortality or all-cause mortality, as we refer to it in studies. That's usually measured at 30 days after the event being the candidemia or the diagnosis of invasive candidiasis.
So one of the most important things when we're talking about invasive candidiasis is to consider it in the differential diagnosis of your patient. And this really starts with knowing the risks and risk factors that will precipitate this infection. The risk factors for invasive candidiasis have been extensively described and they're shown in the infographic. People who experience Candida colonization are perhaps one of the groups of people that are more likely to get this infection. Then we have gastrointestinal surgery or perforation, particularly if the upper GI tract. Neoplasia has always been a risk factor. And perhaps one of the most important risk factors out there is going to be the presence of a central venous catheter. Traditionally, we have considered broad-spectrum antibiotics as one of the main drivers of a dysbiosis that creates a niche for Candida to take over. And perhaps some of the most recent risk factors that we have described are being a transplant recipient, whether it be solid organ or stem cell transplant. People on immunosuppressants ranging from steroids to more sort of selective T-cell depleting agents. People who are in the ICU are at incredibly high risk of this infection, both from the critical illness and the interventions that they're undergoing, as well as from the long-term permanence in the ICU, where they're continuing to be at prolonged risk. One of the most important observations that we have out there is that after about 10 days of being in the ICU, the risk of Candida increases dramatically. Classic risk factors also include diabetes mellitus, low birth weight and prematurity for neonates. Acute pancreatitis is a big driver of this infection. It is estimated that about 25% of people with severe acute pancreatitis may be at risk of this infection. Within neoplasia, we always consider neutropenia a particular risk factor. Older age has been described as well. And CDC has really postulated a very important risk factor for community-acquired candidemia, which is injection drug abuse. This is one of the downstream effects of the opioid overuse pandemic that we're going through. Again, another risk factor within the ICU is going to be mechanical ventilation as a marker of the severity of illness of the patient. Mucositis, again, important for the neoplasia population, where we have a portal of entry for Candida to translocate into the bloodstream. Finally, we have hemodialysis and left ventricular assist devices, where we have direct invasion of the bloodstream. And when LVAD devices or hemodialysis catheters get colonized with Candida, this is kind of the perfect environment for dissemination of the disease. Major surgery in and of itself is also associated with this infection. And parenteral nutrition provides both the portal of entry and culture media for this particular infection. We also, again, use TPN as a surrogate marker for the acuity of illness in our patients. Finally, the topic du jour, COVID-19. We all agree that we're experiencing a worldwide pandemic where we're having a large amount of patients hospitalized in sometimes improvised ICU units, staffing shortages, people have prolonged stays. We don't do the normal things we do for these patients like bathing and catheter care. So COVID really turned out to be the perfect storm for a coinciding outbreak in the number of cases of candidiasis.
Luis, let me ask you a couple of questions, if I may. First of all, let's talk about surgery, because I know that it's perhaps a common misconception that it's really just abdominal surgery that is sort of the risk. My question is, is it all major surgeries, or are there, for instance, is orthopedic surgery, which is major surgery, is that a substantial risk just as an intra-abdominal surgery? Do we bother to stratify those things? Is it just a matter of, you know, if they've had major surgery, that is sufficient?
Well, that's a really good question. I think both of us can agree that abdominal surgery, abdominal perforation is definitely going to be at the highest tier of risk for invasive candidiasis. But other major surgeries that land you in the ICU or with a very prolonged hospital stay are also considered risk factors for this disease. Again, if we think about a patient with a thoracotomy or maybe a patient with a pelvic fracture who's going to be staying in the hospital for a long period of time, we start accumulating risk factors like length of stay, catheters, nutrition, antibiotics, and that's how major surgery turns out to be a driver of risk.
Okay, another question relating to risk. So there are a whole list of risk factors that we've identified over the years and are generally accepted as being predisposing to candidemia. Do those deserve stratification? Are some more important than others? And how would you, if you had to, how would you rank them if you had to?
That's a great question as well. So again, we in general classify the risk factors as those that directly, you know, provide a portal of entry for the Candida or have a pathophysiological causal mechanism for this disease. And some of them are just really markers of severity of illness and acuity for the patient. in the past, we have attempted to rank these risk factors, do specific combination of these risk factors to create clinical prediction rules. And it turns out that those are really useful tools to assess risk systematically when you want to protocolize treatment or prophylaxis in your patients. But then again, we always find limitations as to very prescriptive structures and very prescriptive scores according to those risk factors. I really take a holistic approach to them. And all we need to really know is that the more risk factors you accumulate, the higher the risk is going to be. And if you're running on a patient who's febrile in the ICU, not responding to antibiotics, and you have a list of maybe 15 of these 20 risk factors, your risk of candida is very high, and you need to consider that in your decision-making as to treatment or no treatment for that patient.
And my final question, I think, is pretty simple, but I have to ask it because these are, I think people get confused about this. Have you seen individuals with candidemia who had no risk factors or invasive candidiasis?
Well, that's
personally, that's I have a hard time remembering that person, but there's almost always. But what is your experience?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's hard to find those patients. There needs to be a portal of entry or a condition that is predisposing the patient to this infection. I really can't think of a situation where we see candidemia spontaneously in a patient that didn't have any of those risk factors.
Yeah. That's been my experience as well. And I think the reason that's important is because when we start talking about empiric therapy, really it's important to recognize when it's really not appropriate to start antifungal therapy in a person who really has no risk factors for candidemia. And so I think that, and we'll get into that very shortly.
So next, we're going to talk about diagnostics. And the first thing we need to think about whenever we talk about diagnostics is good diagnostic stewardship. We have learned over time that the best performance of a diagnostic method is always going to be in a population that has a high pretest probability of having the disease. And this is, again, where very judicious use of diagnostics in patients that have accumulating risk factors is likely to yield a higher diagnostic performance of such test. The other thing that I really wanted to emphasize, working on what Pete had already mentioned, is that early targeted treatment reduces mortality. And one of the keys to targeted treatment is early diagnostics. So be thinking about candida in your critically ill patient with accumulating risk factors and promptly doing blood cultures or non-culture-based diagnostics is likely to yield a faster time to diagnosis and a better optimization of the use of antifungals. So currently we have two methods to diagnose candida, which are traditional microbiology and non-culture-based diagnostics. Traditional microbiology includes blood culture, which has been for decades the gold standard for this disease. And unfortunately, we have a gold standard that has about a 50% sensitivity, which is obviously limiting the number of patients that would be benefited from being treated. And the other limitation we have with blood cultures is they're slow. You know, in the best of cases, our blood culture turns positive in 24 to 48 hours. Sometimes they don't really turn positive for 48 to 72 hours. And as Pete was mentioning, delaying antifungals until we get a positive test, if we get a positive test, is associated with increased mortality. The other gold standard has always been biopsies and cultures from sterile sites. And here the complexity is that the population that is at the highest risk of invasive candidiasis and other fungal infections is also a population that is very unstable to be going for diagnostic tests that are invasive. and whenever we get cultures from non-sterile sites, we are kind of left wondering whether this is true infection or if this is just colonization. So as you can appreciate, we have several limitations with traditional microbiology. Therefore, we have moved on to non-culture-based diagnostics. This include primarily beta-D-glucan as a panfungal marker, which in the ICU setting is most likely to indicate invasive candidiasis, and molecular tests such as PCR that is largely non-standardized throughout the world. And then we have a new sort of panel-based test like Septifast or like T2 that are targeting specific sort of primers for Candida. This can be done directly from whole blood and they get us a much quicker diagnostic. But again, here we start getting into an issue of sensitivity, specificity, if we don't choose a high-risk population, and we're also starting to incur cost by doing repeated monitoring of these markers. Sort of following the pathway of traditional microbiology, it is very important to really not just have yeast in the blood culture, but to do what I say, get a name and last name for this yeast. So we need to go to the species level. And this, using traditional microbiology, is going to take us 2 to 3 days to sort of do biochemical testing on this yeast and be able to tell whether it's Candida glabrata or Crucii or Saccharomyces. And now we have a shortcut for that, which is MALDI-TOF, that allows us to get a very quick identification within a few hours of us growing the isolate in a plate. We've been moving to automation with blood culture panels and ID and susceptibility panels. And again, these ones are faster than traditional microbiology, and they have been fairly well validated versus the standards. But still, for problem isolates, we still recommend using traditional microbiology and maybe working with a reference lab to help us sort out the actual identification to the species level and the more detailed susceptibility testing using the reference standard by CLSI or UCAST. Very important to emphasize that, again, the state of the art at this point in time is to perform antifungal susceptibility testing on all sterile site isolates. That includes all isolates from the blood and all isolates that were obtained from a normally sterile site, like an intra-abdominal cavity or a pleural space, because antifungal susceptibility testing makes a difference. It will change the management of the patient, and it'll confirm the susceptibility or make us go away to another antifungal when patients are failing. So currently, both the US and European guidelines do recommend that we go to susceptibility testing for all of these isolates causing invasive disease.
Okay, excellent. Luis, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about your comments. First of all, regarding blood cultures, I think we've all dealt with the frustration of blood cultures that are drawn high volume judiciously, and yet they turn out negative, and then you learn in a postmortem that the individual had disseminated candidiasis. What can you do to optimize the usefulness of blood cultures? And I guess what I'm asking here is there a value for fungal culture media, high volume blood cultures, frequency? What can you do? What can any of us do to optimize that? Because as much as we want to rely on some of the non-culture based diagnostics, we're still in an era in mycology where we seem to be still stuck with cultures. And so they're going to be with us for a while.
No, that's a great question. And I think we can start off by improving the pretest probability or likelihood that the culture is going to be positive by carefully selecting our patients, those who are symptomatic and have risk factors for the disease. So randomly doing blood cultures has never been a real good proposition out there in ICUs. And as far as blood culture technique goes, you mentioned high volume blood cultures. Those are known to increase the yield slightly for fungal organisms in particular. But perhaps one of the interventions that's available out there is use fungal blood cultures or lysis centrifugation blood cultures that do increase the yield from about 50% to 70%. So we're gaining about 20% sensitivity, but by no means they're what we would expect from a gold standard, which would be, you know, 90, 100% sensitivity. And basically the other problem is contamination, right? So very often we're left with positive blood cultures in a patient that's totally asymptomatic, doesn't make any sense. People are arguing whether, you know, we should treat or not. And in general terms, again, we recommend against randomly culturing people. But in a patient who is symptomatic and they have a positive blood culture, I really want to emphasize that we should never basically say this is contaminant disregard, because untreated candidemia has an extremely high mortality in an at-risk host. So I think those are kind of the common pitfalls and ways to go around them with blood cultures.
Thank you. Last question. How do you use the beta-D-glucan in as a supplemental test to identify individuals who may have invasive candidiasis? Do you use it in targeted populations, in the ICU, neutropenic patients? How do you use it, or do you use it? Because it's, I think there's still a lot of confusion.
Yes, there's really two good ways to use beta-glucan, which are as part of the surveillance program that you have for your high-risk host, where you're sampling twice a week or three times a week. Again, very high-risk host people in the ICU or your neutropenic patients. And when you have a linear trend and you see something going up, that would be your cue that this patient indeed may be developing a fungal infection and it's time to act early. This is what we would call preemptive therapy. The other way to use beta-glucan efficiently is on your ICU patient who's febrile. They have all the risk factors for the disease. You have negative blood cultures, and knowing the limitations that we just discussed about blood cultures, you elect to treat empirically for candidemia or another fungal infection. And at that point, you could be drawing a beta-glucan. And when you get your result back, which is typically going to be, you know, 24 to 48 hours if you don't do it locally, actually beta-glucan has an extremely high negative predictive value. And if the result is negative, you can consider that as a de-escalation trigger for your antifungals. So kind of a stewardship intervention based on beta-glucan. Sort of drawing random beta-glucans is not very useful. Doing a single beta-glucan when you have a febrile patient and making big decisions based on that, not very useful either. Again, the two strategies that we want to really recommend are surveillance or de-escalation as part of the stewardship program.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And so the next important decision they have to make clinically is whether or not to treat for invasive candidiasis in a patient who's at risk, probably coupled with significant clinical factors to go along with that. And so we, as clinicians, we tend to look at our treatment choices sort of in three different categories. Probably the commonest use of antifungals in the hospital is for prophylaxis rather than targeted treatment. And prophylaxis is, as one would expect, it's usually targeted to individuals who are perceived to be at high risk. And in many, many cases, really can't afford to sustain another insult, such as invasive candidiasis. And so this might be a select population in an ICU. It might be a certain type of transplant, such as a small bowel transplant or a pancreas transplant, where antifungal prophylaxis really, or targeted to candidiasis, really makes sense, and there are data to drive that. And so, you know, prophylaxis is a wonderful thing when it is done in a thoughtful and targeted, you know, preferably something that's been demonstrated to be really of benefit. One of the problems we run into with prophylaxis is this is an area where there's a huge amount of antifungal overuse, especially as it relates to fluconazole, because it's so easy to give, seemingly without many side effects except for drug-drug interactions. Now, the next type of therapy is empiric therapy. And empiric therapy really should be defined, I believe, as individuals who now have symptoms, but they have that are compatible with invasive candidiasis or candidemia, and they are at risk. Maybe a neutropenic patient, for instance, maybe a patient who had abdominal surgery 3 days ago, as examples. And so you don't have culture or diagnostic data yet, but you think the risk is high enough that it could be, you can justify giving empiric antifungal therapy direct targeting invasive candidiasis. Where I think we have the most data for sure is in the preemptive and targeted category. And this is, of course, for individuals where you have data in hand, microbiologic data in hand, either in the way of a culture, or if we want to kind of parse it out a little bit, preemptive therapy is when we have a marker, for instance, a T2 marker or a anti-manin type of assay if you're in Europe, or maybe a PCR type of assay. We would like to think that these are the same as culture, but you know, to this point, it's difficult to see their equivalence. And so the difference between preemptive and targeted therapy is really pretty gray, but it really kind of is based on culture versus non-culture-based diagnostics. And then, you know, of course, within this is kind of how you select that either prophylaxis or empiric therapy or preemptive therapy. And I think it's important to say that for preemptive and targeted therapy, we consider those sort of the approach one and the same. In other words, if you really have a marker and you think that individual has invasive candidiasis, well, then you have to behave therapeutically as if you have a positive culture. That's been our general consensus, I think, over many, many years. I think there's much more variability when it comes to empiric therapy, again, because there's not as much data to support its use or specific agents to be used in certain circumstances. And so it's there's a lot more variability, I believe, in that realm. In terms of first-line therapy, which I'd like to kind of focus on here and for the rest of this short discussion, I think that the data, aggregate data, really do strongly suggest that the echinocandins are first-line therapy for invasive candidiasis. And then once those have been initiated, we have an organism in hand or possibly an organism in hand or a marker or something to identify the species. And we have an individual who is also improving, then we can start making decisions as to step down therapy or transition therapy, whatever we would like to use as a, you know, as a term there. And so for the non-neutropenic patients, the echinocandins, I think, really make the most sense. The data really strongly support this. And the other category of patients, of course, are neutropenic patients. And in this group, I personally don't think there's a huge amount of difference between the iconic Ambens and the lipid formulations of amphotericin B, although I believe that most of our hematologic colleagues strongly prefer the echinocandins because they really don't like to deal with the renal dysfunction that's associated with the lipid, even the lipid formulations of amphotericin B. So there's good data supporting both approaches, but the safety issue strongly favors the echinocandins. And while fluconazole is an option, I think that in most situations, it's not a great option, simply, especially in neutropenic patients, because of the fact they're neutropenic, and we're kind of focusing on the need for cytal therapy. And so, you know, I think if I were to summarize, I would simply say that, you know, the echinocandins really have kind of changed our approach to invasive candidiasis. They are fungicidal, rapidly so. They are tolerated very, very well for the vast majority of patients, few drug-drug interactions. And the resistance rates, although concerning, are still low enough that we can use them with relative confidence. I think the exception would be if you're in an area of high endemicity for Candida auris and you know that you have an echinocandin strain, a resistant strain circulating, that's a problem. If you're in a hospital where there's a high rate of echinocandin resistance to Candida glabrata, you've got a problem. But those sites are and circumstances are relatively few. And so for now, at least, we heavily rely on the echinocandins as first line therapy.
Thank you, Pete. I have a couple of questions for you. The first one is about the need to act fast and act early. Are you aware of any data showing that, you know, time to initiation of antifungal correlates with mortality in candidemia?
Sure. Yeah, there have been a couple of studies, Luis, as you know, Kevin Geary, Marian Colef, and others have put together studies that pretty strongly indicated that there were two essential features. If you know, of course, effective antifungal therapy, but the timing was really important. And I believe in one study, it was within 24 hours. If you didn't initiate effective antifungal therapy within 24 hours, your mortality rate significantly worsened. And I think that was the, I may be getting this confused, but I think that was the Kevin Geary study. Marian Colef indicated that source control was also a huge, huge important factor. And so getting control of the source, initiating antifungal therapy rapidly, those two things were paramount in leading to a success or optimizing the chances of a successful outcome. If you didn't have good source control in an individual who was quite ill or septic, their mortality rate was in the 70s, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. And the other question that I have for you is, would you mind commenting on the David Andes patient level meta-analysis that really drives the guidelines as to why echinocandins are the first line therapy for candidiasis?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and it's an interesting story, and we can't go through the entire story. But one of the things that's unique to candidemia studies is that starting from the beginning with the John Rex study that was published in 94 through most of the studies that have been done up until then, I mean, through then, 2022, they've been designed very similarly with similar outcomes, similar endpoints, et cetera. And so while they're not absolutely interchangeable, you can take those data and compare them and be comfortable that you're dealing with apples and apples. And so what David Andes and a number of us did in a study that was published in around 2013 or 14 is he assimilated all the data from those randomized trials for candidemia, and it was close to 2,000 patients, and it included, you know, 6 to 8 major trials that were all designed very similarly. And, you know, the bottom line was that it really did appear that receiving an echinocandin as first-line therapy was one of the most important things that led to an improved outcome. Interestingly, not surprisingly, how you handled a central venous catheter also led to or also influenced the outcome. If you handle the intravenous catheter, central venous catheter properly by removing it, those patients tended to do better. Now, that indicates that the echinocandins by themselves are superior to, say, an azole, like fluconazole. The anidjilafungin fluconazole study that Pfizer did and published in about 2006, that came very, very close. And by some analyses, anidjilafungin was superior. But that's not the story that was published in the New England Journal. And so I think that you take that individual study and then the combined analysis that David Andes did, and you really have to conclude that the kind of candidates are first-line therapy, fluconazole second-line therapy. And so I still think it's appropriate to call it step-down therapy because you're going from, you know, one level of intensity to a different level of intensity. And so I think that's important. So we learned three things from that, you know, that, again, echinocandins is first-line therapy. How you manage intravenous catheters or central venous catheters is important. Age was important. Mortality was associated with age. And the other one that was important is Candida tropicalis had the worst outcome. Candida tropicalis. And that was, I think, among those, all the observations to me, that was a bit surprising.
Perfect. And actually, that's a great segue for our next section where we're going to talk about optimization of therapy.
Okay. So at this point, you've initiated therapy. The patient has a diagnosis or a presumed diagnosis. And now the question is, how do you move forward? Of course, for most of us, the branch point is doing well, not doing well. And hopefully most patients are doing well. And in fact, most patients with first line of echinocandin therapy are going to do well. So that if they follow along the path that you expect to see, along about day 5 to day 7, maybe as early as day 3, you could begin contemplating the transition to oral fluconazole. And you can do that in the setting of an organism in hand and either susceptibility data available or susceptibility that are predictable. So for instance, a Candida albicans, a Candida parasolosis, Candida tropicalis, outside of an epidemic resistance type of situation. If you're dealing with a Candida glabrata or Candida krusei, then of course, most of us would feel more comfortable choosing voriconazole. Voriconazole is active against krusei, whereas it's not always active against glabrata, but the MICs tend to favor voriconazole. Personally, I think that, you know, if the patient is doing really well, you could probably go to even high dose oral fluconazole in the patient with glabrata. But I really prefer to have my MICs in hand before I make that distinction. But that's just it's really kind of more of a personal type of thing. But the complexity here is, or the difficult situation is, when is a patient not doing well, or what to do when the patient is not doing well? And there are a number of reasons that a patient may not do well. Could be the wrong drug. Maybe you're on, drug is not susceptible, or the agent is not susceptible to this drug. Maybe you really don't have the right diagnosis. Maybe you are dealing with an intra-abdominal abscess and you've isolated Candida, but in fact, what's driving this infection is an anaerobic organism, or more likely a gram-negative organism. Maybe their host factor is that you really just can't control. Neutropenia as a prime example. Maybe the drug itself, while the right drug, is not getting good levels or not getting effective concentrations where it needs to be. And then I think the perhaps among these things, so perhaps the most common cause of failure and the most remediable in most situations is inadequate source control. Most of the time we're referring to removal of an intravenous or intravascular catheter, but it could be drainage of an abscess. It could be an infected valve, an infected heart valve. And that can be really essential to curing and allowing this person to make significant improvement. And so when confronted with those different types of challenges, I think that you have to just necessarily take the steps that are outlined here. What can you do to optimize their underlying immunosuppression? Is there something you can do that? Is there a catheter that needs to be removed or can be removed effectively without causing the patient harm? What do you need to do with the dosage or the frequency of the antifungal? Or do you need to change? Do you need to upgrade? Do you need to go to, for instance, if you started on echinocandin, should you escalate perhaps to amphotericin? Is that possible or is it necessary? Is combination therapy necessary? Is that going to be prudent in a situation where maybe there's endocarditis? And of course, here's where it's also absolutely essential to understand what you're dealing with. And by that, I mean, you really need to understand the organism. So you need that species level and ideally also its susceptibility data. The species level is relatively easy to come by in this day and age. Susceptibility data, a little harder. Many sites don't do it. It's a send out. And yet you can generally get those data 5 to 7 days after the isolate has been identified as a candidate species. Now, in addition to that, there are other key factors that we really have to consider. And these should be considered in anyone who has candidemia. Now, one of the most controversial ones, it used not to be controversial, but now has become controversial, and that's the need for a dilated fundoscopic exam. I don't know many infectious disease people now that feel like the dilated fundoscopic exam is entirely unnecessary. We've all seen sporadic cases of endophthalmitis occurring in patients with organisms of all the different species, but dominantly with Candida albicans for sure. But there's no way to predict who will and will not develop endophthalmitis. The argument is being made that, well, you treat them anyway, you're arguing for 2 weeks of therapy, and so, you know, what difference does it make? Those patients don't, or if they do well nonetheless. And I'm just not sure that the data really support that. So I'm not at a point where I'm comfortable dropping the dilated fundoscopic exam except for symptomatic individuals or people who are unconscious, which has been the proposal. We do advocate central venous catheter removal when it's possible and when it's a likely source. There obviously are situations where it can't be removed or the patient's neutropenic or, you know, it's not really deemed as a likely source. And in those situations, it may be okay to hold on to it, but I have a very low threshold for removing these. We believe in their data now to support this, that infectious diseases consultation, either a direct consult or a remote consultation, if you don't have that individual available in your hospital, it really, really significantly impacts outcome. Mortality is impacted by having an ID consult, mortality and morbidity. And so we strongly, this is not self-serving, but we strongly advocate calling in an infectious disease person just to simply go over the data, look at the data with you. And if it's something especially that you're not all that familiar with doing, then this makes all kinds of sense. And it really helps to bring in someone who's dealt with this a lot to help you to feel more comfortable with what you're dealing with. And finally, another area that's kind of controversial, it actually is very controversial, is use of the echocardiogram. Should we be doing these routinely? My answer is no. There aren't any data suggesting that you must do these in individuals simply because the patient has candidemia. Certainly, if the patient has persistent disease, persistent candidemia, if they have underlying valvular heart disease, those are two red flags for sure. Patients not getting better, they have persistent fevers, et cetera, but not as a knee-jerk type of thing. I think the dilated fundoscopic exam falls into a different category. Presently, my opinion, everyone with candidemia needs a dilated fundoscopic exam with very few exceptions.
Thank you, Pete. I have, again, a couple of questions for you. One is, we're aware of the studies by Jose Vasquez talking about de-escalation with fluconazole at day 5 to 7. Do you think we should be de-escalating sooner if we have microbiology data and the patient is doing well? Could we be thinking about de-escalating day 3, for example?
Yeah, and I it's a great question, and I think that the current and kind of now the most recent candidemia study that's ongoing in published data, but probably more experience than anything else, that in fact, that has become the practice, that when people become stable, a febrile, they don't have a repeat positive culture, you've got a predictably susceptible organism, then de-escalation to fluconazole at day 3 is quite doable. It's really quite doable. But again, it's not for everyone, and it's in selected individuals who are less sick, who can take oral. You look and you know that they're going to do well. I mean, those are the individuals. And so, yes, I think that there's all kinds of sense in making that distinction. The Joe Vasquez data got us on this pathway towards stepping down to oral therapy. And thank goodness that he did, because it really reflected what we were doing in practice, but he kind of codified it by looking at it in a study setting.
Very good. And the second is really more of a comment than a question. Obviously, you have published on the value of an ID consult, as well as Andre Speck. It looks like involving an infectious diseases consultant is associated with better antifungal utilization, better control of the source, and it has been associated with decreased mortality, which is very important. And I think one of the other interventions that we can think of is this bundled management, where investigators like Oliver Cornelli have published checklists that you need to follow for your patients with candidemia. Mm-hmm. And there's research that shows that if you do follow those checklists, mortality and length of stay improve. We all hate practicing cookie cutter medicine, but it's always good to have a prompt of things you need to be thinking about in your patient. So I do think there's actual good value in implementing this management bundles, and we need to be cognizant about them and sort of promoting their use.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that physicians my age call that cookbook medicine, where you do this and this and this and this and this. But the truth is, a good clinician, a seasoned clinician, does these things kind of automatically. But what's the harm in having a reminder that makes you go through that checklist? There's no harm in that at all. But the better, more experienced clinicians do this anyway. I think to document it and to go through a checklist mentally or on paper really makes some sense. And there's no harm, and it sure does seem like there's a lot of benefit to having this approach.
Finally, it's time to talk about prevention. And I think all of us can agree that the best way to deal with Candida is to not deal with it. And there's evidence-based interventions in the literature that have shown to decrease the incidence of this disease in hospital settings. Perhaps the most important and most powerful intervention we can really consider is the CLABSI bundles. For those of you that don't know what they are, basically in the early 2000s, we realized that the incidence of bloodstream infections in the United States was pretty high and rampant, and that doing evidence-based measures to reduce the incidence of these infections was kind of hit or miss. It was depending on who was running on these patients and whether they were paying attention to infection prevention practices. And therefore, we took from industrial safety, from quality improvement, and we realized that it was very useful to bundle evidence-based interventions and have checklists that would actually trigger people to, on a daily basis, in a reliable fashion, do the things that we know that prevent central line-associated bloodstream infections. And I think the number one way not to have a central line-associated bloodstream infection is not to have a central line. So being very judicious in when you're inserting a catheter and prompting people every day to remove them goes a really long way in avoiding these infections. The bundles also include things like choice of site. We know that femoral lines get infected a lot more than like jugular or subclavian lines. The prep for inserting the line is very important. Chlorhexidine is associated with lower infection rates than betadine or alcohol. The line care is very important. Having label lines with date of insertion, keeping the tubing clean and free of clots, changing the tubing on a regular basis, again, goes a long way in avoiding contamination of this line and therefore avoiding infections. Another important intervention in the ICU setting is chlorhexidine baths. We have seen that these are important interventions to reduce the microbial burden in the ICU patient, both in the terms of bacterial and fungal organisms. And there's randomized trials that have shown that people who are bathed with chlorhexidine-based soap have lower infection rates in terms of not only CLABSIs, but UTI and surgical site infections. And when we analyze the microbiology of these infections, we see that the benefit is across the board, both for bacterial pathogens and fungal pathogens like Candida. And finally, we have the possibility of trying to prophylax the patient for candidiasis and pharmacological intervention. And again, the recommendation to do prophylaxis in an ICU patient is primarily driven by two factors: the risk profile for the patient, those patients that have accumulating risk factors or have one of those clinical prediction rules, or units that have very high incidence of candidemia, and we have really sort of considered about 10% of their CLABSIs being related to Candida as a trigger point to consider doing a more systematic intervention with antifungal prophylaxis. Antifungal prophylaxis is dangerous if not protocolized, because if you're not careful, you end up giving antifungals to a lot of people that don't need them, and you drive resistance. So again, this is one of those interventions that we prefer to leave to the end after bundles and bathing before we sort of start getting into the risk of creating resistant organisms. Finally, I want to talk about a specific pathogen, Candida auris, as we have discussed in other programs. And at the first part of this program itself, Candida auris is kind of the perfect storm of microorganisms. It's an agent that not only can be multi-drug resistant, where we can very easily end up in a situation where we don't have a treatment for this particular patient, but it also spreads in healthcare settings without control. It's kind of the Acinetobacter of the yeast world. And we have the perfect storm here, a highly resistant agent that can easily transmit in healthcare settings, and therefore the level of alert that CDC has pushed out regarding Candida auris. So when we have a Candida auris case, what's very, very important is to use approved cleaning methods for this pathogen. Basically, anything that is rated to clear C. difficile would be rated to clear Candida auris. For hospitals that have advanced cleaning methods like UV light or hydrogen peroxide vapors, we also recommend using that. Anytime you have a Candida auris case in the unit, the recommendation is to screen the other patients in the unit, particularly contacts, if there's been any contacts. And we also recommend speciating all the yeast in that unit while we have a possible outbreak. And that would really help to identify people who are colonized and preemptively isolate them for this infection. Very important, we have Candida auris in different facilities throughout the United States right now, and having a good communication between facilities advising you're transferring a patient with Candida auris goes a long way in protecting the receiving facility. And likewise, when you happen to notice an outbreak in your facility and you've been sending patients to other facilities, it is really a good idea to communicate to the receiving facilities that you're currently experiencing an outbreak and that patients you have transferred may be colonized as well. And finally, Candida auris is very highly transmitted through healthcare workers, their hands. So really pushing hand hygiene programs out there, emphasizing both soap and water or alcohol-based, which actually does work pretty well for Candida auris, goes a long way in reducing contamination in the hands and reducing sort of vector transmission by healthcare workers from patient to patient. Again, at this point where experiencing multiple outbreaks of Candida auris throughout the country, and it is very important to know that this is not just another organism and that we need to do very specific things to control outbreaks and avoid spread to other facilities.
It's a nice summary, Luis. Just a couple of questions. Other than chlorhexidine, are you aware of any data suggesting other types of baths or, you know, routine cleansing reduces the incidence of invasive Candida infections?
Yes. In general terms, bathing patients makes a really good sense. Just regular soap and water baths or wipe wet baths are very, very useful in reducing the microbiome load in these patients. However, given the choice, we would always prefer using chlorhexidine, because it is actually shown in randomized trials to reduce the microbial burden anymore more than regular soap and water. I do have to mention that some patients don't tolerate this bath very well. They have skin irritation, and at that point, they actually become counterproductive, because if we irritate the skin, we have sort of abnormal anatomy and an abnormal function in the skin, and we can create basically the niche for Candida to take hold and other microorganisms, and we end up getting more infections than we solve. So very judicious about using chlorhexidine in people that have intolerance.
My last comment slash question is, when Candida auris was first described in the U.S., I think we really expected it to explode. And while it has spread, I think the spread, my observation, at least, has been that the spread seems to have been limited. And I think that has largely been through the efforts of really good infection prevention. We have had no cases in Alabama. I know you've had some in Texas, of course. But so I don't have any personal experience with it. But as an observer, it just seems like it hasn't exploded as it might have. Do you attribute this to, you know, infection prevention? Is it a softer strain, one that's not as multi-resistant, et cetera? Or what do you think?
I do think that the United States has increased focus on infection prevention compared to other countries where we have seen more widespread transmission. As you will know, all hospitals that participate in Medicare and Medicare need to have infection control programs, and all of these hospitals have these bundles wired into their regular routines. So that's why I think we have seen very limited spread in U.S. hospitals. However, nursing homes are a different story, and that's where we're seeing a lot of the little outbreaks and transmission that we see currently throughout the states. Yes, I do agree that we probably, this many years into the description of this pathogen, we should be seeing a lot more. But I think this is kind of a testament of the good infection control practices that we have in the United States.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you. Let me start by saying, first of all, what a pleasure it's been to have this conversation with Luis. This was his baby. He hatched this idea of Canada infographics several months back, and really with the assistance of our group, our colleagues from Terra Nova and the MSGERC, we've been able to bring this to fruition. I'm really proud of the fact that we've gotten this out in the public and hopefully targeting individuals who can use this information regarding Canada and invasive Candidemia and invasive candidiasis, as it relates to understanding it, the diagnosis, the treatment, and the prevention. And Luis, I think the comments that you brought to the table are very, very well-founded and extraordinarily helpful. So it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Pete. This has been truly interesting and amazing. I think we have discussed some really interesting infographics that can be used for medical education in different settings. We hope that these graphics are shared with learners of all levels, from medical students to house staff to practicing physicians, particularly those who don't normally see Candida, like our surgical or hospitalist college colleagues. And I do really want to recognize the amazing insight that you have provided for this program. I think going beyond slides and going beyond infographics, your decades of experience showed in your comments. And it's been a pleasure to share this stage with you today. And again, I want to thank our sponsors and thank Terra Nova for putting this program together. And we hope that this is the first of many infographic shows that we put together.
Yeah. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.